9-2-2-2. Want some whiskey in your water, sugar in your tea? What's all this crazy question you're asking me? This is the craziest party that could ever be. Don't turn on the lights, cause I don't wanna see. Mama told me not to come. She said, that ain't the way to have fun, no. Open up the window, let some air into this room. I think I'm almost choking from the smell of stale perfume. And that cigarette you're smoking about to scare me half to death. Open up the window, sucker, let me catch my breath. Mama told me not to go. The radio is blasting, someone's knocking on the door. I'm looking at my girlfriend, she's passed out on the floor. I've seen so many things I ain't never seen before. I don't know what it is, somebody shut that door. Mama told me not to go. Oh Lord, Mama told me not to go. She said, that ain't the way to have fun, son. That ain't the way to have fun, no. Mama, mama, sing it to me.
Jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. Right now. Right here. Right now.
Go.
Well, welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howell, Jimmy on the board. SP Futures down 1. NASDAQ Futures down 13. Do we have Professor Lou?
So, I like Randy Newman's Mama Told Me Not to Come. It's one of my favorite songs, but I haven't heard that version.
And that's Three Dog Night.
That was that Three Dog Night live?
Yeah.
Yes, I haven't heard their live version. I've only heard the studio version, which has the great line at the end. You know, the radio's blasting, someone's knocking at the door. I'm looking at my girlfriend. She's passed out on the floor. I've seen so many things I ain't never seen before. And then the last line, which they changed, I don't know why, but the last line is, I don't know what it is. I don't want to see no more.
I saw those guys live twice. They were a very good concert band. Spectacular, in fact.
It doesn't surprise me a bit, given some of their songs. You know, Jeremiah was a bullfrog, yeah. Joy to the World,
yep.
And they also did on the cover of the Rolling Stone, right?
Yeah.
That was the other one.
Yeah, but they had a at the time, and I saw them later when everybody was 100 years old. They had a spectacular African-American drummer. He was just off the chart. He would do a drum solo that was incredible. And so they had guys in there that really could play. I saw him at Notre Dame. I saw him at Western Illinois.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, I appreciate, Jimmy, I appreciate the music choices that are leading in for me versus our somewhat aged
standard
other openings. Yeah, standards. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, now if Jimmy could cobble together a new one like Matt Weber could, we'd be all set.
Actually, you have quite a nice selection here. It's just that no one really goes through them.
Well, it's because everybody has to go for another job, pretty much. But anyway, a lot of stuff going on in the world, Lou. What are things by you? It's cold here. It's got to be snowing by you.
Not where we are right now. It's actually we're still in the 60s, but we're getting down to freezing at night just about.
Well,
so
the
classic Indian summer.
There's two. Well, we might have an Indian summer here because we're actually supposed to get a frost tonight. And when most don't know, is your it's only an Indian summer after the first frost, right?
I don't know. You know where the term comes from, right?
Actually, no, but I know. I think it's supposed to be warm weather after the first frost, where you see everything already dried out, the corn and everything, and yet it's warm.
Yeah, it has to do, as I understood it, when I first learned about the term, it has to do with the fact that it was not a pleasant term initially, because it related to attacks by Native Americans on settling on New England settlers, and the Indian summer was again cold in the morning, warm in the afternoon, and it created a mist, the fog, because of the cold air mass with over warm land that would cause fog, and that created perfect conditions for, you know, attacks for the Indians if they wanted to move up on settlements. So supposedly that was one explanation for it. But in any event, I didn't from a meteorological perspective, what you say makes sense, but I don't know if that's correct.
Yeah, well, which camp are you in on the Blue Moon? There's two camps there too. There's all kinds of camps on this stuff.
Interesting you would ask that. Oh, by the way, I don't know if you could still see it, but that comet that's coming inside the Earth's orbit, I got a good look at that over the weekend. I thought the blue moon was a, well, there's two explanations I've heard of that.
Yeah, there's two.
One is that it's a function of an after image left on your retina after you've stared at the moon for a certain amount of time and you look away. That's one explanation I've heard. I can't remember what the other one is.
Well, the one that just about everybody has, it's the second full moon in the same month.
That's right. Okay.
But other people, they claim it's the more correct assumption, is if you take a quarter of the year, there's the first full moon in the quarter. That's the first moon. Then there's the second, and then there's the last. So if you have four moons in a quarter, it's the third one, because there's no other name for it.
Okay.
Which, well, could be in the same month, could not be.
I've come to distrust all of the names of the moons, because if you go in and pull up Google and say, you know, give me the names of all the moons, you know, there's all kinds of supposedly moon names now. I think I attribute this to the Weather Channel, which, you know, is always looking for something to increase its clicks. Like naming winter storms, which is something we've never done before, they've got, you know, the strawberry moon, the wolf moon, the salamander.
Well, there's
moon,
some that are pretty standard across moon. The board, and then there's a few that have where the current name changes from the Indian name. So there's like two, but most of the time, like the wolf moon, I think is or the harvest moon that's across the board, but then there's another. There's one that's called a beaver moon, and then a winter moon, or something. There's some that have two names.
Yeah. Well, I'm one of those guys that goes up and says, "Oh, look at the moon," and that's about as far as I get in terms of tracking it. Although when I'm up in the mountains, if you're up in the mountains and you're at, you know, away from big city lights, the sky, and you're up high, the sky here is at night is just spectacular. I've spent more than a few evenings in the summertime out on our deck, just laying, you know, basically laying on my back, looking up and watching the sky. We're up high enough that you can, and the air is clear enough that you can see the Starlink satellites going over, and, you know, and they're easy to identify because they go over to basically a straight line.
How do you, when you, by the way, here's AI, of course, now says the term blue moon can refer to an extra full moon in a calendar year. That's a third interpretation.
I too complicated.
Yeah,
too
my complicated. My grandfather, who was I think ICE would be after him, Luke. I think he ditched his uncle when he was like age 12, and I don't know when he got his citizenship. He did at some point. But he would tell me, and he was a guy who was into all kinds of stuff, even though he was a boilermaker. He said, if you ever want to see the sky, you got to go out in a far out in a farmer's field and lay on your back and look up. But because you got to can't be anywhere near the light of a city.
Yeah. Well, that's excuse me. That's basically what we have up in the mountains. You're away from all light. Pikes Peak is between us and Colorado Springs, so there's no. There's some reflected light in the eastern sky, but there's not very much. And you can catch all kinds of stuff. As I said, you could, you know, with the naked eye, you could see the satellites going over.
Well, my crazy brother, who of course is the distinguished president of PTI Securities, but drags me and a buddy up to Quetico Park. You know where that is?
Is that north of Chicago?
It's north of Minnesota. You should know where that is. It's the Boundary Waters area.
Oh, Boundary Waters, sure. Okay.
And so he says, well, let's go up there and go canoeing, right?
It's dark up there.
God,
I've been
yes.
up there a number of times.
It, you know, but the most spectacular thing is it's so dark, but when the lake is dead calm, you can look up or you can look down because the entire reflection is on the water of the stars.
Yeah.
It's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. I mean, I've never seen anywhere else like that. You just can imagine that, listeners. If you look up, the water is like an absolute mirror, and the stars are so light. But you know what, Luther? There's so damn many stars in the sky. I couldn't even pick out like the Dipper. There were a million stars up there.
Yeah. It once you get up, and especially at altitude, this is true. So southwest of us is a place called the Great Sand Dunes National Monument, or I guess it's a national park now, and. It's pitch black out there in the evening. There's no lights, and it's one of those designated dark sky viewing areas. And when you get, I mean, we're out there one evening and you look at that and you start saying, okay, now I understand how the ancients were, you know, the Greeks and Roman astronomers, how they could sit and start to figure. Yeah, watching the movement of the planets, watching the movement of the stars, because it was so clear that you could, with no ambient light, that you could track this stuff, which then triggers me on to another totally unrelated topic. I was at Stonehenge about 2 weeks ago, and have you ever been to that?
I've not.
Part of
but
England?
I was on the tarmac at Heathrow. That's my England. Story.
Okay, so Stonehenge has been on my bucket list since I ever read about it. Since I first read about it as a kid, and I finally got out there. And
how do you get there from where? Where do you?
I was in London, and we took a we just they were running a day tour out to a couple of points out west, and this was one of the stops. So I got to spend about an hour wandering around listening to the. The guide who
well,
was
isn't the current configuration hasn't it been repaired?
Well, it was put up. It was restored in 1924, I think.
Okay.
So when they some British landowner bought it, and they, you know, there were these stones lying around on the ground, and the guy this is the turn of the 20th century, and the guy apparently, you know, called the local British. Whatever it was, our antiquities department, and said, "Hey, I think I got something here." And you guys, you know, the site's out. The site's been in use since 15,000 BC, they think. And he said, "I think I've got something here." And they came out, and then they started realizing what exactly it was. It's kind of amazing when you look at it, and you know, it's not they're now, I don't know. Numerous of these sites where these kinds of structures, not exactly as big as Stonehenge, but where these kinds of structures were erected, but this one and has a as a number of them do, but this one's got a particular astrological function, and you start rethinking. They think the stones were moved and assembled sometime in between 7,000 and 5,000 BC, and they're not really sure exactly when this thing was first put up, but it obviously is a structure. They've been able to reassemble it, and then they've put it back together. It's the astrological aspect of it, though, is that it apparently lines up with the sun on the days of the equinox, the vernal and autumnal equinoxes. The sun appears right between these vertical slits in the plinths that are holding up these cross beams. And when what I tell everybody, or what I've told people since I've seen it, is it's one of these things that you come up on and it doesn't look real. It looks like something. It's totally foreign. It's looks totally out of place. You're in this verdant English countryside with you know, green grass, and they think that the reason it's on this, because these stones are on this particular site, is that at the time it would have been put together, England would have been heavily forested. But this area where the site is has apparently never had trees on it. There are no marking. Don't know. Just one of those areas where trees didn't populate. It's at the top of a rounded hill, and as I said, there's no indication that trees were cut down or that it had ever been there. It's just like a meadow, and so they started burying people there, cremated remains and others sometime around, as I said, as early as 15,000 BC, and then it became some kind of quasi-sacred gathering place, and then they started putting these stones up. The question, obviously, and these things are huge. I mean, the structure itself is, the height is maybe 16, 18 feet high, and the stones are thousands of pounds, you know, 20-ton rocks that, for the big ones, had to be the vertical and cross beams had to be moved from a quarry that they've identified that's about 20 miles away, and no wheels. They think they put them on sledges and then pulled them with manpower, and the estimates are it would take somewhere between 80 to 120 men to pull this thing any distance at all, just to get it moving. So this thing was, the big stones were dragged about 20 miles. The other stones that are referred to as blue stones, because they have kind of a bluish tint to them, were quarried from a site, I believe, something like 200 miles away.
And there's no river or anything. There's no water to get it there.
Oh no. Yeah. And so they think the other stones were quarried.
How would those guys even find a quarry 200 miles away in 5,000 BC?
You know, there are all kinds of interesting questions on this. The ones that were quarried 200 miles away, they think were put on rafts.
But I'm saying, how would these guys sit there and go, okay, we're going to do this. By the way, we got to find a quarry. Everybody spread out and find a quarry. And somebody's 200 miles away without getting, shot, without getting knifed by some other dude out there, finds a quarry, goes, here they are. How would that even happen?
Right. Somebody looks at these rocks, and I mean, it's not the kind of thing that would have just been sort of in casual trade. Somebody looks at these rocks and goes, you know what? That would be just perfect for this thing I'm building 200 miles away.
We're talking about people that lived at probably 35 years old. I mean, it is,
I know.
You know, I'm gonna lob one out there, and the listeners are gonna absolutely think, wait a minute, guy's a money manager and he's nuts. I think when this stuff went up, Lou, it all went up sort of about the same time. The pyramids, I think they had help. I absolutely think they had help.
So the archaeologist that was with us as the guide said, yeah, that's one of the interesting theories, that there was some kind of extraterrestrial motivation. My or help. My thought process, the first thing that I thought when I saw the site and you start hearing about what it took to put these things up is not so much how they did it, although that's a mystery too, but why? What would motivate you? And again, if you've got 100 guys dragging a rock 20 miles, the first thing, what?
Yeah, there's no religion.
What's the end game?
There's no religion that could be that strong at that time to make
well,
you do that.
I mean, I was trying to think, what would you offer? Because that's a huge amount of manpower for a Stone Age, pre-Iron Age culture. That's a huge amount of manpower.
I don't know if I mentioned this to you. It's crazy for Stocks and Jacks, but the thing that set me off on this, I always had a kind of a suspicion that there had to be some help on this stuff. But there's a guy on YouTube. There's a big thing about the Great Pyramid. And evidently now the Great Pyramid and even the Sphinx now, they've decided they're like thousands of years older than they thought they were. But the thing that got me about the pyramid is the guy says, okay, over time we've deduced that the stones were brought up the Nile and people got them over here and there's all these ramps and stuff. And he goes, you know, all that's perfectly possible. He said, but the thing has how many million stones in there? And he said, just the idea was it took 30 years to build. He goes, that's like 200 stones a day or something, some incredible number or ton. Because there's no way the volume. But the thing that got to me was he said, but here's the kicker, that nobody at that time. And he goes, I'm going to challenge us now to be able to do this. He goes, look at the base. He goes, the thing's been here for 10,000 years. You know how much this thing weighs? He goes, mm-hmm. look at the base. There's no deflection at all. One side hasn't sunk 5 feet or 6 feet or something. He goes, we couldn't do that today, form a base for something this heavy and not have some sort of deflection. Whoever picked the spot or prepared the spot, there's no way it could have been those people. No way.
Well, yeah, and so we think the same thing. The same thing here, and I, one of the things that you realize when you look at these places, and it's the same thing when every time I go to a Roman site and I look at what the Romans were able to accomplish, you realize that ancient man or the Greeks, ancient man was a lot more competent than we give him credit for, in terms of sort of basic things like engineering. So the cross beams on Stonehenge were perfectly level when the site was operational. So these things were arranged in this circle. One side of the circle has a slit between these stones that captures the equinox, the sun at the equinox, just perfectly with a shadow. The top was completely level.
Well, what do you do if you get it up there and it's off an inch? How do you fix it?
Well, that's a good question. So again, the way they're mounted on top, Chief, they're not just placed up there. The cross beams, the top stones that run across the tops of these huge vertical stones, are actually mounted on a ball and socket kind of joint.
Wow.
In other words, they chiseled down the tops of the vertical stones.
So they modeled it after a human hip.
May well have been, but they've got each one of the tops of the stones, the vertical stones, has a protrusion, a sticking up. You know.
So what did you use the chisel? You had to find a harder stone.
Yeah, good question.
Well, you had to find a harder stone.
You got to find another rock somewhere to bash it with.
Yeah.
They not only chisel out and remove the top of the rocks, you know, sufficiently to leave this ball on top of it. They then chisel into the horizontal stone a comparable hole to the right depth, so that this thing sits on top of it and sits level. And not only that, it's level all the way around. So another question I asked was,
it's the same way you joined carpentry before you had nails.
Yep. I said, okay, so we have 100 guys that you've got dragooned into this, maybe they were slaves. They were just captives.
These are the Druids, right? Supposedly, Maybe
Druids, Picts, Saxons, Celts. Yeah, I mean.
But why would you, just your day, finding something to eat?
Exactly.
How you would have enough people that could
how
do
would
this.
You have enough calories?
Well, but what I'm saying is, if you got 1,000 people there, and you got 500 people doing this, the other 500 are going to be doing a hell of a lot of hunting to feed all 1,000.
That was my question too, and that's, you know, I mean, this archaeologist's comment was that it may well have been done with slave labor, so that they didn't care if
well,
they
you still got to eat.
Well, they might, yeah, but they don't have to worry about keeping them fed fully. They just let them, you know, they just let them die if they don't perform.
What was the population? How did you even have enough slaves? I mean, Egypt probably had some population. I can't imagine Britain did.
Well, and so Egypt was an agrarian culture. These guys, as far as we know, were not agrarian, which meant they were hunter-gatherers, which meant you were out there, you know, beating the bushes, you know, grabbing a pheasant or a deer or whatever you could kill. And so, again, where do the calories come from to support 100 guys pulling these things and hundreds of people chiseling, digging, burying, lifting? You know, where's the calorie support for that kind of a workforce? How did they do that? So another interesting mystery. But anyway, this is, as I said, diverges from a little bit from our discussion, but the astrological and astronomical aspects of this thing are fantastic, and again causes you to think what on earth would motivate somebody like that. I'm all for the,
you know, I guess the evolution theory, I think, makes a lot of sense, but it all happened too fast, Lou. Something showed up and helped us out.
Well, the guide said when she was talking about this extraterrestrial explanation, she said, "Yeah, people have started going around looking for a giant black slab," and with the obvious reference to 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Yeah,
you know, where the black slab comes down and alters the pre-human psyche so that they suddenly learn how to mentally get smart and learn how to develop weapons and tools. So anyway, fascinating place. If you get a chance to go out there,
did you ever get to go to Bletchley Park?
No, I did not go there. I obviously know what it is, but have not been out there.
For those that don't know, that was the original spot where all the code breakers were outside of London on some guy's named Bletchley's estate. And actually, our buddy Robert, I don't know if you ever met him, from the Bletchley, the son, or Grant, somebody, is now the curator of the place, and he actually came over to the Federal Reserve here and have a talk, so Robert kind of knows the dude. So if we ever get there, I think we could get the double secret tour.
You know, another fascinating example of just human brain power and culling through your population to get smart enough people to look at setting up a mechanism to break the German ultra code. Yeah. And other codes.
Pretty amazing. Lou, I talk about shifting gears. When people are watching, and this the policy, just as a, you know, we may have some differing views on things and stuff, but both of us, I think, are searching for the truth. And when you have these Venezuelan boats now, where we seem to be blasting, with not a whole hell of a lot of evidence, there might be some, but there's some that. And so last night I'm on YouTube, and I get this national, I forget the guy's name is, but he was citing these reports from the last few years regarding drugs that come in, and he was talking about how many thousand people die of drug overdoses, and almost all of it now, not all of it, but is some fentanyl related, I guess, you know, if you take a, what was the stuff before fentanyl? It was the oxy, whatever that. It makes you die at some point, but it's not. You don't really die by an overdose.
Opiates or yeah.
Okay. What's the stuff that where you look like you're 80 when you're like 35 and your teeth fall out of your head? Was that crystal
methamphetamines?
So the guy was saying that all the reports that the government has published is that Venezuela and Colombia are a huge source of cocaine. That basically the conclusions were that they were not the route of fentanyl. The fentanyl, the route is Chinese making the precursor stuff pretty much through Mexico and other places. Pretty much Mexico. He said, so fentanyl, whatever reason you're blasting the Venezuelan ships, I mean, I listen to this and I'm going, okay, if people are dying from some stuff and we can find a way to stop it, you know, if we make sure we're doing the right thing, I guess I can roll with it. But then you hear something like this and you go, wait a minute. And the conclusion was, there's another motive here. If it's regime change or what it is, it's just a regular person without, say you don't have any political affiliation, what, how do you make sense of this? I mean, you're sitting there, you guys reading from a government report saying Venezuela is not the source of fentanyl. Yes, cocaine and other stuff, but not fentanyl. And yet we're asked to believe that we're blasting people without any kind of a trial, or we're capturing the boat and finding the stuff for free, that all of a sudden it's there and just believe me. How do you, if you want to believe somebody or you want to think we're doing the right, how do you make head or tail of something like this? It doesn't seem to match up ever, does it?
I've looked at this because these activities hit a little close to home, because I taught law of armed conflict and the use of military force at our special operations, the Air Force Special Operations School down in Florida back in the day. So you always worry about this kind of stuff, the application of military force outside of a declared war or some kind of clear strike, and when this looks, you know, a defensive strike.
When was our last fully declared war? Was it World War II?
I think it was World War II.
All right, so we've had about 100 wars since then. But go ahead.
Yeah. So the issue, there are a number of issues, but the big one is this a legal use of U.S. Defense Department resources? The DOD is specifically prohibited from engaging in law enforcement activities in the United States and in other places. And if you're going to use military force to strike a non-military or sort of non-state actor like this, you need to have it designated as one of several categories, typically involving a state or a quasi-state at some level. So I think our position here is that these boats are part of an effort by the government of Venezuela and supported by the government of Venezuela to import addictive drugs into the United States. So if that's the case, and it wouldn't surprise me a bit, and I've listened to people who are much more knowledgeable about what's happening in Venezuela than I am, say that yes, this is what's going on. There's a definite anti-American push by Maduro. He's in league with China, Russia, and several other bad actors who are using his country as a staging area. And this is part of a long-term program to destabilize the U.S. and putting these drugs in. I think that's the theory, and so we, having tried interdiction or having tried non-military interdiction and trying interception and arrests, are not convinced of the effectiveness of this stuff. And I don't, it's not small, it's not a small amount of stuff coming in, and it's obviously getting here, and it's obviously being sold. It's insanely lucrative. You've got submarines and fast boats and airplanes and everything else moving the stuff into the U.S. So it's not, whatever percentage it is of the total number of, you know, the total amount of drugs that are coming, illegal drugs that are coming into the U.S., this is not a small operation. And so the idea is that if you kill these people, rather than simply arresting them, you start to offer a more of a deterrent to being the folks who are out there trying to recruit people.
Well, it gives one hell of a lot of power to one person.
Well, it's not one person. Excuse me, it's not one person making the call.
I think it is one person.
Well,
he says it is. He says it's him.
Well, but he simplifies. He simplifies everything.
But I mean, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when we blockaded Cuba and had the big row at the, if we thought a Russian ship was coming in with missile parts, we surrounded it, we blockaded it, and then we said, by the way, here's the parts, you idiots. We just blast them out of the water and said, take our word for it.
My understanding is that the congressional leadership has been briefed on this and has been given the evidence. I mean, we're not coming up and revealing all the evidence that we've got.
Evidence is at the bottom of the ocean.
Well, no, Tom. We don't. These boats are identified. In most cases, these boats are identified from the minute they leave the harbor.
How do you know what's on it until you actually look at it?
Well, they know what's on it because they've been tracking the shipments, and they could say, okay, this shipment's going to this boat. Now, are we doing it? Are we doing it down to this guy's on here, and we know who he is, and we know where he came from, and we know what he's got in his pockets.
I can't imagine we have that many feet on the ground in Venezuela. Maybe we do.
I would think we do, and I would think we've. I mean, this is clear and present danger stuff.
But I'd rather
Tom Clancy.
I'd rather have, if we have somebody on the ground there, and we see a film of the fentanyl truck showing up loading onto these boats and we blast the boat, I guess I got no problem with it, but unless we see something like that, I'm not
excuse me, I'm having the same problem you were having earlier. I'm not convinced, or I'm not worried about the validity of what we're hitting. The boats we're striking are not fishing boats, and they're not sightseeing boats.
Okay.
They're fast boats carrying cargo, and again, the point here is we have a state actor doing stuff to try to damage us.
But where are they going? I mean, there's a lot of questions that I don't know, so I'm asking. They're essentially like a cigarette boat, for lack of a better term, right? For carrying some cargo, fast boats.
Yeah, although the ones I've, but I mean, the video I've seen is open top.
Yeah, so I'm saying you're not gonna take that thing from Venezuela to Florida.
They're running them either to boats offshore for pickup.
Okay.
They're running them for into one of the islands, you know, offshore where they can be staged.
Okay.
I don't know exactly where the final.
I can't imagine that boat pulling into Miami Harbor. I mean something. There's got to be some kind of chain of something going here.
Fine. They're moving them to another boat. But I'm reasonably comfortable, and that. You know, these guys have been designated as a terrorist organization. They're being backed by a state actor. We've tried to arrest people. It doesn't work. The money is too good.
Tried to arrest these guys on the boat?
Well, we haven't tried to arrest the boat drivers. We tried to arrest the people that were coming in before we changed our tactics, and so that doesn't work. So now what we're doing, and again, are we blowing up? Are we blowing up every boat? No. Are we blowing up half of them? Probably not. But the idea is that when you start telling people, we're going to kill you if you are engaging in this kind of conduct.
When are we going to get to the part where virtually all the money made on this stuff is made in this country? And we don't seem to be able to deal with that.
I don't know. That's the federal law enforcement stuff. We're seizing stuff right and left. But I mean... Is there a big lot of enthusiasm in Chicago for arresting drug dealers?
I think so.
No.
Fentanyl, I think there is.
No. If you come in and start sweeping neighborhoods in Chicago and picking up the guys that are dealing drugs on the street, and you start working your way through there, you run into the same problem you do with arresting people with illegal guns in Chicago. You know, the local law enforcement has no enthusiasm for this.
I think that the reason why they don't have a whole lot of the person I'm looking for, Lou, is the person who's controlling the distribution. Because we've had, we had Eric on while ago, and when Eric was it was Crystal Meth at the time, I think. I don't know if you remember when Eric came out. He came out of school, and Eric's retired, so he was a beat reporter. Was it for the Washington Post or somebody? And he said he used to cover like 3 murders a week, maybe. And then all of a sudden, was it Crystal Meth hit town, and it immediately jumped to like 15, because it was such a lucrative thing. But they used to, the cities, you know, we talk about the cities of people getting shot and so forth in the cities. Didn't it change for a while? Wasn't Elizabeth, New Jersey, a big transit hub?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, and people were getting shot there, and it got essentially too hot. They moved where? To Jackson, Mississippi. Then they moved to, was it Jackson, Michigan for a while? And they would move from city to city, and all of a sudden the city would flip. I don't know if any of those guys ever getting caught. That's where the money is.
Good morning.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know where.
You got to mute somebody there, Jimmy.
It's Andrew.
Yeah.
So I don't know what the. Again, I'm not. I don't have a right in my back of my head about these issues. I just know that local law enforcement has not been able to deal with it, and so this is. And again, the focus here, and the reason that this becomes a proper subject for defense. Right. Actions is that you've got the actions of a state actor involved,
or they don't care.
Well, I mean, they do care because they have to at least provide some justification.
No, I'm talking about the Venezuelan guys.
I'm
not talking about our guys. I'm talking about their guys.
I think it's pretty clear that we've got the Venezuelan government involved.
We're operating on the same
principle that we operated on in the Middle East, where we were striking targets in Iraq and Syria that were terrorist and again state sponsored or connected with quasi state organizations, and that's a threat to U.S. security. Well, DoD comes in.
I'm not saying you've ever been in a place like this, but this Venezuelan thing's been going on now for, God, since as long as you and I have been on this show. they basically bleep can their oil industry. They've got like no currency or anything. How does the place even exist? I don't want 9 million Venezuelans piling across the border, but I sure as hell would think if I was living there, I'd be the first one out of there. I mean, how does a place that screwed up even? How do you get on a bus? How do you get a paycheck? I mean, how does the thing even work? They seem to spend all day long worried about screwing with us. Sort of like the same problem you had with Stonehenge. What do they do all day? Do they manage to find?
Right. Well, I don't. I mean, the economy there runs
how
on whatever it runs on. It's, you know, oil sales
but their oil sales are. That's why we wanted to build a pipeline to make up for the Venezuelan oil. We don't get any more.
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we had, I don't know what, 1 million of them come across the border over the last.
Yeah,
10 years.
I'm surprised there wasn't 20 trying to get here.
Well, here in Denver. We have a large number of Venezuelans, and with them the associated problems that population dragged along with them.
What is so different about different cultures? I mean, obviously here, even as warts as we have, if we have bad people as presidents or representatives, eventually we find out a way to get rid of them. At least we always have, and these places. I mean. I told you a story about the guy who was next door to me in Notre Dame. The guy whose name was Mario Cardinal. He was in Nicaragua or someplace. His family was fairly wealthy, and evidently they were afoul of the current strong man, so they couldn't wait to get Mario out to Notre Dame for school so he couldn't get harmed. And God, Lou, that was 50 years ago. The place is still a problem.
Yeah.
How is it? I mean, Venezuela is going to. Well, the guy rigged the election, right? But I'm saying it is so bad. How do people not, I'll use the term, do something about it? I'm not encouraging anybody to go out and start shooting people, but for God's sake, I mean, it's way worse than when the Magna Carta came in Britain.
I can't really explain the cultural differences. There are, obviously, certain cultures, and I point to Western liberal democracy, are set up in such a way that they can flourish, and they do, and they set up a system that allows them to flourish. Some of the other cultures, you know, don't absorb that don't absorb those values, and they don't buy in. And frankly, if you want to go back historically, the elements of Western liberal democracy that got imported into Latin America and South America were not the values of Western liberal democracy that got imported into North America.
Well, if you look at
the Latin American culture that grew up under Spain or from the influence of Spain is completely different than the culture that grew up under the British.
Well, I mean, you look at Africa, and I'm not a big student of the, but obviously probably the oldest continent in terms of people, in what, 20,000 years, there's never been a democracy of any sort. It's been strongman after strongman for thousands and thousands of years. And I guess, I have an amazing amount of, well, not an amazing amount, but I have a lot of Mexican friends. And, you know, people that work in the building and that I know of and I've worked with and even some people in the finance industry that are here are so into American values, and they talk about Mexico and they just go, well, you know, it's run by gangs. Nobody seems to change it. Nobody seems to want to change it. And yet, when they're here for a while, they become this culture. They go, this makes sense. This is the way it ought to be. I mean, I guess you could learn by example or whatever, but maybe the people in Venezuela don't know the difference. I mean, Argentina, how many times have they been a growing economy only to get a new leader and turn back and go the other way? In the 1920s, they were most up-and-coming country in the world, and all of a sudden in the 30s, they went totally backward for 50 years. I mean, it's crazy, isn't it?
It is. As I said, the culture, the European culture that got imported into those areas that supplanted, and I note that it's, you know, it supplanted the native culture that was there. The indigenous culture was there because you had basically a pre-industrial or an industrial culture coming into a Stone Age culture. The clash there, the industrial culture prevailed, but the culture that got set up in, as I said, in South America and Latin America was completely different, and you could see this if you travel down there. We went through Central America a couple of years ago, where the British or the Dutch set up shop. Those cultures are, you know, reasonably democratic and not overly corrupt. I'm thinking places like Belize and the Dutch Antilles and things like that, where you have the Spanish culture that predominated with its very hierarchical patron system that was established and organized in a very top-down hierarchy, you have these other kinds of cultures that are, you know, that are in problematic. I mean, that's all I get. That's the only thing I can point to. With respect to Africa, tribal, you know, it's astounding how heavy the tribal influence is still there. I mean, this is what's playing out in places like South Africa, and a number of other places. Tribal, family, clan alliances predominate. By the way, it's not just Africa. That's one of the reasons that what's happening in Gaza right now is so terrible, where areas that the Israelis have not liberated or have not taken over control, you have the Palestinian clans basically warring, and you know, one of the reasons that Hamas was going through executing dozens of people over the last few weeks is because,
well, some of those videos are interesting, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, those
that don't know, there's Hamas is doing the stuff like the Japanese did in Shanghai, or where was it?
Nanking.
Where they're all laying in front of them, they're shooting them in the back of the head, and everybody's wearing a mask.
Yeah, and these executions are clan-based executions. They are culling the population that they can control and executing the heads of or members of various families that in some cases the Israelis were trying to assist to destabilize the Hamas, you know, control of that area. But these executions are, they're saying, well, these are collaborators. They're not collaborators. There are other clan heads.
Yeah, there are other guys looking for power.
And you know, the anti-Hamas elements. So this kind of thing, this family clan mentality, which is not just found in Africa or the Middle East. I mean, you see it in Central Asia. When I was working in Kazakhstan, it was the Nazarbayev family and clan, and it was very tribal. You see remnants of it in places like Italy, with the various families of you know, mafia and organized crime. You see it in Russia. This kind of stuff percolates up to a very high level in these kinds of places.
Well, that is really the local government, though, in a lot of those places. That is. I mean,
but the great strength of, you know, Western Europe and other places, for example, China, is that you've got a government that arises and can reach across those family boundaries, and control the internecine kind of conflicts that result. And that's how you impose civilization there. Otherwise, you end up, you know, you end up with this constant tribal warfare, like what you see in what you saw in Africa early on with the Zulus and other tribes that were constantly.
And you're still seeing it.
It's right. And what you saw in North America with the Indians, Native Americans, constantly at war with each other.
Well, it's kind of a longer discussion, Lou, but because we're almost, but you know, I read this thing. You know, I always try to drop back into economic terms and why a lot of this stuff happens, right? It's when you're going to drop back into law, or in, I'm going to drop. But I read this thing about if you look at the Native Americans here in the U.S. and what was going on, and you look at one of two things. One is no domesticated animals and no real agrarian stuff. So there's no real reason for people to live together. So it's always a conflict of, no, that's my buffalo herd. No, it's my buffalo herd. Because it was all kind of... But if all of a sudden you actually had people where you could stay in one place, raise cows, raise chickens, those kinds of things, all of a sudden you're forced to find a way to live together.
Which, yeah, you start worrying about property.
Yeah, and you start worrying
about commerce.
Right. It was a whole different... There was no reason for the Native Americans to ever think that way, because there never really was a... I mean, it wasn't like they didn't have places they lived. They did, but... There, I mean, same way in Africa, I would think. It's still pretty much a hunter-gatherer operation.
Well, in the New World, where you saw the establishment of stable agrarian cultures, you see pyramids... You see these fantastic cities. You see, you know, what you and I would recognize as sort of a quasi-modern kind of culture arising.
Even those places. Yeah, even a place like Babylon.
I mean, the Aztecs did this. The Mayans, the Incas, where they could set up these kinds of stable food sources. And again, it's agrarianism. And if you go into the American Southwest, if you go to some of the cliff cities in Southwest Colorado and Northern Arizona, you will see where when they had access to water and they could set up a stable agrarian, you know, growing corn, you know, raising fish, farming fish, you see these kinds of structures get set up. And then, you know, in the case of the Anasazi, I think that's the way it's pronounced here in the United States, the climate changed. And it dried up, and when that stopped, they that culture fell apart.
Well, hey, so what are you up to this weekend? You traveling, or are you hanging around? What are you doing?
No, I'm actually home for the weekend. I'm going to be doing errands, doing my normal weekend stuff. How about you?
Well, we got my brother's got his big apple squeezing thing this weekend.
All right,
everybody from the softball team. It's a huge party. Everybody works, and I cook and. Everybody squeezes the apples. It's an excuse for everybody to get together at the end of the year, basically.
And drink cider. Good.
You got to wait for it to ferment. You can't drink it after you just squeeze it. You can have a glass.
So you drink last year's crop.
Oh yeah, you could have a glass of apple juice if you want.
All right,
take care of yourself. But SP Futures down 12, NASDAQ Futures down 74. Jimmy, you want to go right to our guys?
Yep, they're right here. Cool.
Guys, how are you? The guys.
Yes. Good morning.
You guys are now become known as the guys on Thursday. You know,
so. Yeah.
that's a very good Chicago term. So what's going on? What's going on in your world? I was with one of my lawyer buddies last night who was actually doing Andrew, I wish you were there because you would have loved this stuff. You know more about it than me. I was being regaled with all the films of the murders in the street at the club, and I'm watching all these camera versions. I'm thinking, all I did was come up here to get a beer. But it's so fascinating, and how there's two guys being tried in two different separate juries and picking the jury for both spots, and the guy who actually did the shooting's already copped a plea. Now, these are other people. This is, the guy's been in jail 4 years with COVID and everything, and he's just going to trial, and he's been in jail for the 4 years. And my buddy thinks he's going to get him off. I thought, this is, can you write fiction like this?
Well, I love the old Ben Hecht stories about Chicago from 115 years ago when Ben Hecht was a reporter, and he said you could get Clarence Darrow for $30 to get you off on a murder charge. So your story reminds me of that.
Well, I was looking at the films. I don't think he did it. I'm sitting there going, whatever. I'm not on the jury, but how do you
one of the Ben Hecht stories, and he wrote for a bunch of Chicago newspapers, but he says. One of the, I don't think it was Darrow, but some other lawyer defending a guilty client. And the guy's mother was dressed up like a washerwoman and started yelling, "I'm his ma, save my boy." And after the acquittal, the lawyer says, "It wasn't easy to get the old gal to dress up like a washerwoman, but that's what we needed to do."
It's when you look at one of the things that I actually wanted to talk to you guys about is with all the strife going on and the fighting back and forth and the political stuff, it really was kind of the theme of the conversation with Lou. I don't think that a lot of, I won't just say the younger generation, I don't think a lot of the people in this country at this point, at least the people I talk to, unfortunately, have enough respect for our system and what it takes and what set us apart from everybody else, where you'll hear people say, "Oh, screw it, the courts are no good, or the judges are crooked, or everybody's in Congress is crooked," and you go, that maybe that's true to a certain extent, but boy, oh boy, look what you have in places where there's none of that. I don't think there's any appreciation of how special our stuff is here, and that's what gets me very, very worried.
Well, it should, and not to talk too much before Wayne really has a chance to say hello, but just half an hour ago, I signed up for a session at George Mason University that's going to have three former CIA directors talking at George Mason University next.
Where is that, Andrew?
It's in just across the river from me in D.C.
So it's like in Virginia?
Yeah. And these former CIA directors, which some of us reporters would criticize back in the day, but they feel passionately about what you're talking about, as do I. And when you ask what I'm doing, I'll just leave this out there. I'm in court covering the Comey case. We got Patrick Fitzgerald from Chicago defending the former FBI director, who's going to absolutely destroy the prosecution shortly. The trial's scheduled for January 5th. So a lot of what I'm doing is covering these cases and trying to identify the enduring values that need to be protected in our court system?
Well, it'll be ongoing. I hope you'll be filling us in on that. Wade, how are you, bud?
I'm good. I'm just waiting for my email from the Donald Trump campaign offering me a piece of the East Wing of the White House in exchange for a small donation to get a meme coin.
God.
I have a funny feeling that may be coming.
I would, you know, it's the question I have to ask, and I'm going to go back a ways here. Way back in the day, like when I first, you know, was on the SIBO, I asked one of my buddies, we were talking, I don't know where I was, but the question came up about representatives and so forth, and he told me this has to be in the 80s, where he says, you know, these guys all put their money in a private trust. The guy was a representative, and you remember the ConCon here, where a lot of those guys ran for ConCon. You couldn't be anybody in office or ever held office, I don't think, to run for ConCon. It's all a bunch of young guys. That's where all the I won't say the current, the retiring Daley was in ConCon, Marty Russo was in ConCon, Madigan, I think, was in ConCon. Well, it was a bunch of young people aged 28 to 35 that got, you know, their posters in people's yards and ran for, and they stayed in politics. But at the time, the representatives didn't make any money. I mean, most of those guys didn't do anywhere near as well as the other people that graduated law with them. And he said, no, everything was going to be in a private trust. You couldn't trade. Nobody. And you think all this stuff is kind of like rules. But it seems like if you just push them, there are no rules. Cheney just said, basically, screw that. I'm trading. And everybody goes, okay. And now everybody else seems to be trading. And you see somebody gets in the White House and everybody must have felt that, gee, that's the people's house, unless you remodel it or fix the air conditioning. All of a sudden, the guy gets in there and goes, this is my place, I'm wrecking it. And nobody says boo. Yeah, I'm sitting there going, was this a convention that the other guys couldn't have turned it into a hotel? I mean, or somebody just had respect for it or didn't? Or is any of this stuff written down? I mean, or people just do whatever they damn well please and nobody ever stops them?
Well, you know, Trump has already said he's going to remake Washington, D.C. in his own image. You know, the last guy that talked about remaking a capital city in his own image was good old Adolf Hitler, who, you know, had Albert Speer come up with this new design. Now, Mussolini also had plans to do that for Rome. And the reason I know a lot about this is I'm going to be releasing a book soon, basically saying anti-fascism is as American as apple pie. You go back and look. You know, I'm going back into the 30s, and we were talking about Hollywood films, but you know, these iconic actors were in these films that were warning. Both before the war and after the war. I didn't even realize that High Noon with Gary Cooper and Grace Kelly was really a statement on the McCarthy Red Scare. You know, here's a sheriff in a town. He's trying to get the townspeople to support him against the, you know, a murderous gunslinger comes into the town and nobody wants to help him. You know, was sort of synonymous with some of the people who were being blacklisted.
You got to tell the whole story about the movie. Gary Cooper is the sheriff. There's this notorious no good Nick and his buddies in town that ran the town. Gary Cooper comes in, rounds them up, tries them, gets the conviction. They're all in jail, and so the town is now peaceful. And to a certain extent, less fun than before, with all these crooks used to run around and gamble and all the stuff in all the saloons.
Yeah.
So now they're all getting out of jail with the idea that they're going to come back and kill Gary Cooper.
Yeah.
Because he looks around for some help, and the people go, "We're not helping. We kind of liked it the way it was before." And so he ends up like by himself. And at the end, he ends up, you know, winning the day, because it is a movie. And the interesting part was his wife, Grace Kelly, who's always memorable, well, she was a Quaker, right?
That's right.
And so she's anti-guns, anti-anything, and she ends up, when somebody's ready to shoot Gary Cooper in the back, killing the guy. So it ends up, she ended up having to lose herself to save Gary Cooper, and finally they get in the buggy, and now all the townspeople are cheering them for doing this, and they get in the buggy because they were leaving anyway. He takes off his badge, he throws it on the ground, and basically says, "Up yours," and leaves. Very powerful movie. Very powerful. Yeah. Maybe one of the most powerful of any.
And you know who said it was the most anti-American movie he had ever seen? That was John Wayne. But the person who actually came out and said it was his favorite movie ever was Ronald Reagan.
Well, I mean, those movies, they can't really be your favorite because you would hope things aren't that way. Yet, you know.
Yeah.
Did you guys remember the thing I sent you guys a couple weeks ago? There was this dude from, you know, I get some of the, you know, amazing opinions from people in this Quora that I get all the time. And one of the questions was, is America ever going to go back to, like, normal? Can it ever recover from Donald Trump's presidency was the question. And this is guys from Europe, and I'm not saying he's right, but it's a point of view. And if the listeners, and I think you guys, the reason why I love these two dudes and the rest of the people on the show is, you hear something that's so totally screwed up, you don't agree with it at all, and the more you think about it, you say, you know, maybe that person has a point. You know, I firmly believe you can never learn anything from anybody who thinks the same way you do. But anyway, the guy's answer was, it's not Trump that's the problem. He goes, America's the problem. America's always been like this. The Puritans were basically assholes. They hated everybody. Yeah. They hated everybody. He goes, America is one of the most repressive racial countries that's ever existed. Look what you did to the Indians. Look what you did to the blacks. Look what you did to the Chinese, and they were done with the railroads. Look what you did to the Japanese that were here. Look what you did to the Irish. This is one after another. It's just the way you guys are. And I'm reading this, and I'm going, well, first of all, I don't believe all of it, but he has a point.
Yeah.
I mean, look, we're doing Hispanics now. If you're Hispanic, pull over. It's okay with most people. They don't care.
Absolutely. And these ICE agents have said, we pick people up just based on the way they look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they picked up a bunch of people yesterday. Half of them were citizens. And I've talked to people that I care about. Say, God, they picked up citizens. Well, they let them go. And then 4 hours later, yeah, but, you know, yeah, but so what? They're Hispanic. So what if you pull them over and end up being okay and you let them go? Well, wait a minute. If that ever happened to you, it's appalling to me. But, you know, I guess now, I mean, maybe Trump has just released the demons that people already had. I don't know, maybe.
Well, it's not just him, but you have well-educated people like Justice Brett Kavanaugh, Yale education, raised in a very upper-class middle family. And he's on the Supreme Court, and he basically says, well, if anybody's a citizen, they'll be released, so, you know.
Yeah, what's the difference?
What's the difference?
I got to ask you guys. The weird part of this is I hear Trump say something ridiculous. Can't be 20 minutes later, the mayor of Chicago says something, and I go, here's a guy who gave us Trump. I mean, I can't. Both of these sides. I ask you this: with this, the Democrats, could they be any dumber? This thing going on with Congress, with this, you know, Johnson not having the House in session.
Yeah, Mike Johnson.
What?
Yeah.
Explain to me this, boy. I tell you what, maybe I'm a little too street smart for these idiots. Why doesn't the Democratic guy, the minority leader, say, look, this is an awful show out here. We're showing up. We're going to be in our seats tomorrow, and we're going to say, we're ready to negotiate. Where are they? That would be an amazingly powerful message. Don't these guys think of anything like that?
They're saying that, Chief.
But they're not there.
I think there's also the fact that the Republicans hold the speakership. It sounds like an arcane job, but there's a position called the doorkeeper of the House. It's sort of like, you know, getting into the security arrangements for that side of the capital. As long as Johnson has the gavel, he also will have the doors locked for the actual House chamber. Nobody can get in there.
That's why, excuse me for this, that is why people are losing to Trump. It's not what you do, it's how you do it.
But they're doing that.
I know. I'm trying to say, Andrew, yeah. I know they are in some way. I'm saying it's not as powerful as 200 people showing up and sitting on the front lawn saying, "We can't wait to get in there. We're locked out. We're ready to do business." It's all the impression. It's not whether they're on Zoom or whether they're ready to go or ready to make a phone call. You know what I'm saying?
And they acted surprised when, you know, the wrecking ball took out the entire east wing of the White House. Wait a minute now. It's not that far away. I agree with you. The Democratic leadership should have said, look, we're all going to go down there to the White House and protest this action. No, they didn't. I mean, having lived in Washington for as long as I've lived there, it kind of was a gut punch to see that happen. It reminded me of what happened on January 6th to a building that I had covered many hearings and had interviews in there with members and whatnot. And I saw one interesting comment that Trump's bulldozers accomplished what at least one set of 9/11 hijackers wanted to do on that day, and put one of them planes right into the White House. Well, you know, here the East Wing is gone. It's a pile of rubble.
Well, I mean, Andrew, I'll give you where I'm going with this, I guess, more because I can't say that I'm a Chicago guy because you grew up like two blocks from me. So you were that close, by the way. It was actually like a half a mile. But anyway, I went to this, Dr. J drags me to this wrestling meet, right, one night. And it's over on the west side where they're there. I'd never been a professional wrestling. I was never a big fan, but it's going on and your usual stuff. People caring about this person winning. And John tells me that when they, always look like they're ready to pin somebody, and then they pop off, and then all of a sudden they pin somebody and they stay down. Well, there's a guy under the mat with a timer. Then he finally whacks the bottom of the mat, and they know that you're supposed to stay down that time. So it's all kind of a show. Well, evidently, Hulk Hogan, who just passed, I think, right? Hulk Hogan, and a week before he was someplace, and he's the heavyweight champion, and he gets disqualified, right? And so he's not there, obviously. And then they're having this heavyweight match. All of a sudden, the crowd goes up like you would never heard. In comes Hulk Hogan with a ticket over his head, saying, "I belong." And he's pointing to the ring. "I belong in that ring, and I had to buy this ticket to get in this building." I'm saying the Democrats have to act more like that. Here we are on the White House or the Congress lawn, and this idiot won't let us in the door, and we're ready to go to work, and we don't know where the hell they are. That it's a much more powerful thing than we're all sitting here by our Zoom ready. I'm just saying.
Oh, I totally agree, and in fact, I'll work my way back through the news, but I found recently some of these black and white 1950s wrestling things. Haystacks Calhoun, 500-pound guy, come in with his overalls and its horseshoe around his neck, and he'd be up against Killer Kowalski. I don't know if you remember that name.
Remember the Bruiser and Crusher?
Yeah. And now we've got, fast forward, an education secretary who looks kind of normal, Linda McMahon, but she's she wants to shut down her department, the Department of Education. And what does that do? It funnels a lot of money to localities to help disabled people and slow learners have a chance at a decent life. And what's her background? Professional wrestling. And it's just come out that she's on some website of flat earth proponents. And wrestling, I started this little riff here for a few seconds ago with you know, fond childhood memories of watching these wrestlers. But that's a very troubled part of our world. You know, it's got steroid problems, all kinds of harassment of the, you know, ring girls and so forth. And to have someone like that as Secretary of Education,
where did Trump find these? Where did he find these people? Where do you find Kristi Noem? I mean, when Pam Bondi, I mean, these people are like, I can't even.
Wayne knows a lot about
Pam. Pam Bondi's one of the locals from down here in the Tampa area. She went to she got her law degree from Stetson University. Now, I don't know whether you get a big hat with that.
Well, let's not be a snob, Wayne.
You've
got worse than that, Dunner.
You know, there's universities, and then there's a place named, you know, with the same name as a hat.
Get into the bad stuff, Wayne.
You know, by the way, Andrew, are you jealous? Because the Baron von Raschke, the Claw, He was an attorney.
I wish I had that.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah, the Texans, they have a saying, all hat, no cattle. I think, you know, we could say that about Bondi. Bondi's the daughter of a local politician who was mayor of this a suburb of Tampa called Temple Terrace. It was very well known, Temple Terrace, back in the 20s and 30s, because it had a huge speakeasy, and one of the people who would frequent it is none other than Chicago's very own Al Capone.
He got around,
yeah. But I mean, she was our Florida Attorney General for, you know, quite a few years, interestingly enough, she had never taken any action against Jeffrey Epstein after he got that sweetheart deal with the U.S. Justice Department and a very mild form of punishment from the state of Florida. So her fingerprints are on this whole Epstein thing just as much as Trump's people are.
Do you think that as the guy went onward in his, I won't say career, but whatever it is, his life, do you think that he actually, FBI and the CIA, were dying to find out what people were doing there and kind of almost protected him?
Somebody was protecting him because Alex Acosta, who was U.S. attorney in Miami, who did that sweetheart deal and hasn't regretted it. He appeared before the House Judiciary Committee in closed session and said he didn't have any issue. He stands by it, but
What's he going to say? Name people?
Well, Acosta did say at one point in time that we got to leave Epstein alone because he's quote unquote intelligence. Nobody really knows. Well, who?
And nobody pressured him. And that testimony that Wayne referenced was recent. But here to go to your point, Chief. As soon as Acosta was nominated to be Labor Secretary, which was very early in the Trump first term, Wayne was in Washington, and he immediately, within a day or two, started a three-part series investigating Acosta with his role in the Epstein scandal and the sweetheart deal for Epstein. And I tried to pick up on that and get the Florida Congresswoman, Frederica Wilson, who was on the House Labor Committee, to do something about it. And she's kind of famous for, she's a Democrat, she wears fancy hats, but it's exactly what you're talking about. They didn't know how to do anything with information or reach the public. Zero interest in this huge Epstein-Acosta scandal. And this was 8 years ago. And now it's back in the news because, you know, we have these new books and continuing revelations, and the Democrats did nothing effective about this, even when the guy Alex Acosta was on his way to being labor secretary.
Well, it's, I guess, the question I'm always trying to, I use the term weasel out of you guys because you're so close to this. Is it possible, really, for us with this, I don't know what exactly you call our governmental system now, Congress is pretty much, and a lot of people would say Congress just go home, they don't do anything anyway, let Trump just do it all, boy, you know, whatever. But I...
No, well, you can't have that.
I'm with you on that, but I mean, the way Congress has taken themselves out of the picture, people are recognizing, I mean, whose job is it to give money to tear down the East Wing? Well, you got a president going out and getting his own money by basically shaking people down, and he's using his own dough. Isn't there some place somewhere? I mean, if I'm Jimmy Carter, I walk in, I don't like this place. Let's wreck it down and make me a bungalow here. At some point, this is not his property. It's our property. But
exactly. And you know, this ballroom he's building is going to be twice the size of the White House. So when you look at the White House, you'll see, oh, look at this big building, and then oh, there's the White House over there.
The guy doesn't even like to dance.
Yeah.
Well, no, it'll be a place to shake down the foreign powers and oligarchs here in the United States.
Well,
want to get invited?
Yeah.
Well, the question I'm zeroing in at, and as usual, I take my roundabout way of getting there. Carl in Florida, you probably know the guy, Wayne. I forget his name, but somewhere back a while ago, I'm not going to say 50 years, but probably 10 or 20. Carl supported some guy to run for representative for wherever the hell he was in Florida on the Republican side. He probably helped him with some cash, but he also was like the guy who managed his campaign contributions because the guy was coming in from the outside. So if you're coming in from the outside and nobody, you know, you got to make sure your stuff adds up, right? If you're a favored person, nobody cares. But so the guy gets in, and then the first thing they did was said, you got to basically kick us your cell phone and you only got to use ours, because if we don't know who you're calling or whatever, this is the Republican committee.
Yeah.
and we're not going to get any committee assignments. Anyway, I think the guy was in one or two terms, couldn't wait to get the hell out of there. It seems like there's this, you're in one or two or three terms, if they don't like you, to come after you, but then maybe fourth or fifth, you either jump the Rubicon like Caesar did, and all of a sudden you're in with the in crowd, and you just seem like you disintegrate to some extent, and to where I don't see anybody having the ability to tell other people to not trade on information. What I'm seeing on that every day is brutal. I don't think anybody has the ability to say to Trump, where the hell are you getting the money for wrecking the East Wing? You don't control the purse, we do. I don't see anybody, and you know, we talk about what's wrong with the economy and the health care. I don't see anybody in Congress that has stuffed their ass with money from pharmaceuticals being able to turn around and say, we got to stop these guys. I think a lot of young people see this as very dysfunctional. They're not wrong either. I mean, I don't know.
That's right. That's right. And that's what I'm working on this book. Fascism through the, say, last 130 years, what they do is they try to make the democratic systems look so dysfunctional that you look at the figure who's saying, I can fix everything, and you say, okay, well, you can have all the power to fix everything. And of course, that's a Faustian deal that never turns out very well. I mean, Huey Long did this in Louisiana. He was also probably one of the most corrupt governors that Louisiana ever had. But he said, I'm going to do this, I'm going to give you this, I'm going to do that. And he did a lot of things for the state, but he also stole a lot of the state money for himself.
Well, I mean, when the attraction of a guy like Trump, when he talks about Chicago and he talks about maybe Democratic state, we got a break here, but or even a Republican state, when he says the stuff he says, problem is he's not wrong. You know, I mean, when he says Chicago's screwed up, and oh, by the way, people need protection, and the mayor comes out and says, what do you mean? We had 900 murders last year. This year we only have 875. We're making progress. That's, the man ought to know that's no kind of an answer. I'm sorry. I mean, SP futures down 15, NASDAQ futures down 94. Doesn't mean that you put some dictator in place to do it, but you also got to figure, hey, there's a problem. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here. We're back.
Hello, welcome back. Stocks and Jocks. I'm talking about Jim Lawler on the board. SP Futures down 13. NASDAQ Futures down 86. Stuff is rife with insider trading all over the place today, if you ask me, but I don't have the proof. DAX down 45.2%. FTSE up 58.6%. CAC around up 20.2%. So they're up a little bit over there. DAX, the only one, is the laggard. Nikkei down 666, that's 1.3%. Hang Seng up 186.7%. Shanghai up 8, so call that 0.2%. Not much going on there. Bonds up 3 basis points, but still under 4% on the 10-year, 3.98. The Bund up 1, 2.57. Oil, this is what I'm going to talk about. Oil jumps 5% after Trump administration sanctions big oil, Russian oil companies. Oil was $55 2 days ago. This oil contract is huge. I sure wish I'd have known that. A couple of futures, I'd be flying to Washington to take our friends out for drinks tonight, Andrew. I mean, that's how much money can be made with these announcements. It's insane. Brent up 297, 65.56. If nobody's front running, boy, they I'm almost. I don't know. I'm gonna ask these guys after I'm done here. Which is worse, dumb or crooked? I don't know. Gold up $52, 41.17. Sounds good, but it was 4,300 2 days ago. So gold's had a horrible week, trying a little bit of a bounce here. Silver up a buck, 48.68. Foreign exchange, and this is what's been doing it. The euro is down to 115.9. It was over 117 maybe 10 days ago. The pound 133.4. It was well over 35 again 10 days ago. And those are big movements. Crypto, which has been getting its butt kicked. A little bit of bounce today, up 814, 108, 876. It was 126 a month ago. So it's down off its highs pretty heavy, too. Jimmy, we got forced traffic, weather, sports. I guess the Bulls won. Is that even sports? No, I don't even know. Who cares?
The NBA has started, and yes, the Bulls beat the Pistons 115 to 111. And at your favorite watering hole, I'm sure it was packed. But the 76ers did beat the Celtics 117 to 116. And tonight we do have the Vikings versus Chargers here in Chicago. It is 40 degrees with a high of 52. It's going to be sunny, otherwise, you know, clear, and a low tonight of 39. In Phoenix, it is 64 degrees with a high of 65, and it again will be sunny with a low of 61. In traffic, right now on the inbound Kennedy, from Montrose, it's 25 minutes. From the Jane Byrne Exchange, it's 44 minutes. On the Edens, inbound from Lake Cook to the Jane Byrne, it's 39. On the Eisenhower, inbound from 290 to Wolf, it is 47. On the Eisenhower, on the Dan Ryan, inbound from 95th to the Jane Byrne, it is at 34. And back to you, Tom.
Guys, one of the same topic we had a minute ago about the money. Quantum stocks surge and report Trump eyeing stakes in the group like Intel and rare earth companies. I seem to recall reading in this country where even in World War II, you couldn't go buy tanks unless somebody apportioned the money. Congress isn't even in session. How the hell can Trump come up with the money to buy a stake in a company? Where's that coming from?
That's a good question. And for all these people who you know, advocate a market economy, laissez-faire, basically what Trump is doing by investing the government into private corporations, that's exactly what the Soviet Union is heading down that path of a state-managed economy. So I don't know where all these free marketing people are now. If somebody had, say it was the Biden administration, they talked about, well, we're going to do something on antitrust here, and then all the free market people, oh, no, you can't, that's government overreach. I don't hear these people now.
This is a very, and I'm going to, people will be bitching at me, but, go ahead. It's a very fascist economic system. A few companies in every industry with their nose firmly up the ass of government. It's a German system. It was there before the fascists. It's their style, and you're right. It's other people have done it. The Russians did it, but the Germans are. The Germans' economy is freer, but even now it's the same way. I mean, banks own a lot of the businesses.
Who's from the inside speaking out? Former Illinois Congressman Joe Walsh wrote a column late last night, and here's the headline of it. If Trump began demolishing the Washington Monument next week to make it a Trump monument, not one Republican would say a damn thing. And Joe Walsh was a conservative congressman, and he's now kind of a pundit, but he's from the inside, he's furious, that's the kind of hard-hitting commentary that's needed, doesn't seem to come so often from Democrats. But so I think that goes to your point, Chief.
Is it fair to say that everything he does, he gets away with, and emboldens him?
Well, he's pushing his... One other quick thing. And I know one of your least favorite topics is insider trading. Well, what did he do this year? He pardoned Chris Collins, who was the congressman from Buffalo?
Yeah.
Did the insider trading stuff and was convicted after a trial. And Trump pardons him because, maybe coincidentally, Collins was the first Republican congressman in the whole country to endorse Trump when he ran for president. And so he lets him off. And what happened a week ago? George Santos, the most absurdly crooked, lying, scheming, phony, Holocaust denier, well, the whole thing, he's pardoned after his convictions.
Andrew, you're the man here. What exactly does a pardon mean versus a commuted sentence versus can you still vote if you're pardoned? I thought Otto Kerner here wouldn't accept the pardon. Is that true or not? I mean, what's the nuts and bolts of this?
There's a lot of nuances here, but for a pardon, and maybe I misspoke, maybe it was a commutation.
Yeah, with Santos, it was a commutation.
Yeah. A pardon, you have to admit wrongdoing, which, of course, the biggest fraud ever, Santos, refused to admit wrongdoing. So they commuted it. That means he got out after 3 months of his 8-year sentence. There's a real question. His victims, who are all over the place of his frauds, they may not get the restitution that was ordered. And
can anybody do that? Is that even considered?
That's part of the Trump pardon power, and the way he's using it to kind of tie things together, he's basically saying to the American public and all anybody who wants to be a crook, if you're with me, you don't need to worry about anything. Look what I did for George Santos and Chris Collins and lots of others, the insurrectionists. But if you're against me, you will pay the ultimate price, and you may end up in a concentration camp in El Salvador.
Why don't people see that? I mean, why? It's so damn obvious to me. But just on the legal point, though, Andrew, if we convict Wayne...
that could happen.
That's not a joke.
No, if we convict Wayne from being a crook, or for whatever reason, and he has to pay $2 million, he's got to serve 10 years. And I look at it and I go, geez, I don't even like this Wayne guy, but 10 years seems a little much. So after 6 years, I say he served enough, and I commute his sentence. Well, he's still guilty. He still owes the $2 million, right? Or does that get commuted too?
I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think as they're working it out in their Justice Department and White House, they'll figure out what they want to do and what to call it. I should know that question off the top of my head, but I don't want to misspeak. But
I thought, well, I mean, I was no huge fan of Blago, Blagojevich. I thought his trial was absolutely the most disgusting thing I've seen here. You know, where one juror said they couldn't get him to convict the guy the first time through, so everybody outed the juror, then had the other jury in the same. There's no way you could get a clean jury here. After you outed the juror and people are on their lawn throwing stuff at him, and, you know, the juror, and then the guy was out of money from the first trial, but. So, but say he was guilty of something, I thought 14 years was over the top. Even if I didn't like the guy, after a year or two, I would have said that's enough.
It was way over the top. It was an outrage, and it's based on a couple things that was big overreach by the prosecutors and the Democrats, who I think were behind it. One, he used foul language. Yeah, I mean. And two, there was an overlap of some things that President Obama in his personal financial dealings on his way up with Resco. And Wayne,
I was so outraged that it brought me to Chicago to investigate that story. I was actually so outraged at what they did to Blago, I said, well, I got to go out there and look into this.
Well, that's where we met you.
But yeah.
On that trip.
But you ruined the guy. Yeah, he basically pissed away all his money on his first defense. Then they said, we're trying you again. And didn't he have a? Did people contribute, or did he have a public attorney the second time, or what was it? It was some story there.
Yeah, I forget. He also, a lot of people forget that his wife was very much in a political family.
She was the daughter of Alderman Mel.
Mel, right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Got to talk about a character.
It was outrageous. And now he's a huge Trump supporter because
he got,
of this over.
He got pardoned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't get pardoned. He got commuted, too.
Oh, he was commuted. That's right. Yeah.
So that means you're still, if it's a felony, you still can't vote. You can't do stuff, right? You can't own a gun or anything.
Don't need to vote to live a successful life.
Well, right.
And Andy, when you accept the pardon, you also are giving up your Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. Isn't that right, Andy?
I don't think that would apply to new activities, but to go back a couple minutes in our conversation, dictators want legislatures to be out of business. So they're getting part of what they want with the shutdown, and Trump has no interest in bringing things back because he's basically got his one big beautiful bill. And he's doing whatever he wants. And you go back to Hitler and Mussolini, they didn't want the legislatures
Well, there was the Enabling Act, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, what was the Enabling Act for listeners who don't know?
After Hitler's made chancellor by a very reluctant President Hindenburg, he was old, he was ailing, but he didn't, here's a field marshal. And he didn't like this little Austrian corporal. It really did boil down to that. He was under pressure to appoint him, but then the Reichstag had a fire, burned down gutted the building, and they found this deranged communist from the Netherlands, and they blamed him for it. Although many people thought it was, the stormtroopers who
did
it. Well,
they blamed the Jews too, right?
Oh, absolutely. The thing is this is a technique used by these dictators. You create a crisis to take full advantage of it. And we've seen that over and over again in countries that have fallen under this fascist control. But anyway, Hitler ran through the Reichstag, which wasn't even meeting there. They had to meet in another place. So the communist deputies weren't even seated because they had arrest warrants out for them, and the socialists weren't seated either because they just refused to accept the fact that they won in the election, sort of like what's happening with the House. This lady from Arizona, she, over a month now since her election, Mike Johnson won't swear her in. But anyway, the Enabling Act was a list of horrendous measures which basically tore up the Weimar Constitution of Germany and put Germany on the path to a full.
Well, it basically gave him a full ride. Wayne, I was going to ask you, but normally I'm not going to forget. I'm going to ask you right now. How close is the House with this lady in Arizona and him not wanting to put her in there? They got more than one or two votes, don't they? I mean, what is the count now?
Yeah, well, she would be. They talk in terms of her being the 218th vote needed to get this resolution passed, this discharge resolution to get the Justice Department to cough up all the Epstein files. But see, that includes a couple of. Marjorie Taylor Greene, oddly
four
enough,
Republicans. Four Republicans.
Yeah, there's four. So what? I think the count now it puts them a little bit closer, but I think Democrats still have a four or three seat edge.
Well, a couple of these interim elections have gone Democratic ways, right? So they're actually a little closer.
Yeah, and even where there were a couple of elections here in Florida where although the Republicans won, the Democrats really doubled their support from previous
elections. Just so the listeners know, I suspect most do, but just in case you don't, if a senator croaks or gets convicted or something, the governor can appoint somebody to fill out the term. But in the House, that's why it's called the People's House. If somebody croaks or gets something, even though it's only 2 years, you have to hold an election like within like 90 days for a new person, even if it's 6 months to go, right?
That's right. That's right. So, well, governors in some states have a little more leeway, and we've seen that happen where, like here in Florida with DeSantis, he drags his feet on some of these districts.
Well, it costs a bunch. It's not like it's easy to do to put an election together, right?
Well, also, the Democratic Party apparatus is weak. They don't have as much funding, and so they can't really crack the whip. And one of the Democrats' problem is they had at least three elderly, sick people who ran for election last year, last November, and won, and then promptly died.
The Nervito, the Nervitos guys to die.
Yeah, and
well, the Nervitom.
Yeah, like Curly said, the Neuvidem guys.
Yeah, the Curly from the Stooges accent. but the problem is they claim to be putting the public interest ahead, and then they're hanging on with, you know, white knuckle grip to the job when they can't do it, and then they die. And that's three seats that have been in limbo for much of this term here.
What I was trying to, how was it the other day? Was it, it was Hal and I or somewhere. We were walking through, might have been Kevin. I think it was Kevin. We were walking through the differences in the parties. And this is just, this is my view of it from what I've read, and you guys can certainly critique and add, that the Republican National Committee is actually, I'm going to say, fairly strong in the sense that there are, well, up until this guy, there were some Republican values that you could sort of always count on if you were conservative, you know, the taxes and those kinds of things. I'm not saying a right or wrong, but I'm actually a proponent of most of them, actually. Conservative, nobody tells me I'm as liberal, but there's, where the Democrats, especially since the unions have gone the way of the dodo bird, pretty much. I mean, not the city unions. I'm talking regular unions. There's not really, people don't send a check necessarily to the Democratic National Committee like they might to the Republican. So the Republicans have better systems, better computers, better mailing lists, better everything. And the Democrats, whether they raise money or not, is very candidate specific. Like, Obama was able to raise money. Hillary was able to raise money. And she essentially bailed out the Democratic National Committee because they were broke, right? I mean, and even in Illinois, if you're a Democrat and you're a good fundraiser, they ask you for money back. They're not helping you. It's the other way around. Why is that, do you think? First of all, is what I said, is that true? And if it is, why is that?
Well, I think it is true. And here's an oversimplification that may have regional variances, local and so forth, but as a general trend, it's a much more clear pay-to-play system on the current Republican setup. I mean, you had Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, becomes co-chair and the real force running the Republican National Committee in the last presidential election cycle. People said they can't do that, but they did it. And so if you...
There don't appear to be any rules, Andrew, right now.
Yeah, we think that there's rules, and in fact there's a disparaging term that some former Republicans use on the Bulwark site and elsewhere, normies. Normies are people who think that the normal rules still apply when they don't. And if the Democrats have a model basically for grassroots, if you want a better country, send in some money. Well, all right. You don't get anything back except maybe hope that your Social Security or medical benefits might be intact. You're not going to get cut in on some insider deal except maybe in some of the regional situations we'll speak about, maybe that you've heard about in Chicago. But I think that's the general landscape.
Well, if you were to ask anybody, actually it's a two-part question, not much time. If you're going to ask anybody what five things the Democratic Party stand for right now, that's question number one. Question number two is, if we actually have a guy that's parceling out money to big firms that are able to basically silence their workers, which they seem to be, how the hell do guys like you or anybody else, how do you fight that one? And it seems like the deck is stacked, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing is, like, sometimes I don't think the Democrats know how to deal with success, because this No Kings rally, which I was at in our little town near here called Plant City, very agricultural and very, very deep red, but we had probably several hundred people show up. But this one was between 7 million and now there's estimates that 9 million people showed up around the country, including like deep red states like Idaho, Wyoming, and Alaska. And the Democrats are saying, wow, that's really... But wait a minute. A lot of these people are in deep red areas. Are the Democrats... do they have a plan to now try to go get those people?
Because, I don't think they have any plan.
I agree with you. I mean, this is like... They're looking at gift horse to the mouth. And, you know... And you know, they oh, well, what do we do?
Yeah, you know, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, and I've said it twice now... The idea of 200 Democratic Congress people sitting on the lawn pointing at the building that they can't get in is just like Hulk Hogan with the ticket. It's absolute showmanship. It's a super powerful, in my opinion, poster.
And that's why Trump always prompts them. No,
yeah, and so and yet they would never think about doing this.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah. I mean, do they? They have no vision. What is the deal?
Democrats need new leadership. Schumer, he may be a brilliant tactician in the Senate, but he comes across as like, geez, you know, the guy's with his glasses down on his nose. I joke around. He has his glasses on his nose because he's still looking for his, you know, his man parts.
God.
Yeah, well, here's something that goes right to your point, and I heard this is probably off the record from a former Florida congressman, but a Democrat. And he said one of the problems with the Democratic National Committee is it's heavily staffed by the children of donors. And so he says, so they get a donation, which they really need, and they reward it with a job of some, you know, maybe well-educated, but not necessarily street-fighting mentality. And so that leads to the lack of fight and vision that I think you're talking about.
I mean, this is... You got to impress people that you're going to do something good for them and that you're trying. You're in Washington. Are you going over to watch the destruction of the White House?
Well, here's what I'm doing. It's kind of interesting, I think. There's a big conference of pro-Ukrainian, pro-democracy people that I'm attending. And so is my brother and sister-in-law are coming down from Alaska. In fact, I'm picking them up right after the show. And what's interesting is they're very politically conservative. In fact, my brother runs the Alaska Policy Forum, which is an ultra-conservative group. And their view, which is not predominant in the Republican Party, is that Republicans need to be pro-Ukraine, pro-democracy. So he's having meetings along with this conference with Republican senators to say, stand up for Ukraine.
Well, good for him. I'm in the same vote on that. This idea that you know you can go in there and wreck half the countries of somebody, and by the way, that now becomes yours in a negotiation. I mean, I don't buy that. It's a good thing we didn't have that kind of mentality during World War II. The world would look a hell of a lot different. Well, guys, fun as usual. I'm sure we'll be going back and forth on the internet, and you guys have a great week. Jimmy, nice job. SP Futures down 2, NASDAQ Futures down 37. So not much happening there. Gold, a little bit of a bounce back. Oil with a big run up. That's the news. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks. And back tomorrow morning, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.